From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with The Current Newspapers. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be joined by Aisha Braveboy. She is an attorney, former member of the Maryland General Assembly, and a candidate for state's attorney for Prince George's County. Joining us in studio now is Susan Swecker, chair of the Democratic Party of Virginia. She's also a member of the Democratic National Committee. Susan Swecker, thank you for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
Tom Sherwood, somehow or the other, sanctuary cities became an issue during the last election in Virginia, despite the fact that there are no sanctuary cities in Virginia. But the District of Columbia is considered a sanctuary city.
It calls itself that.
And now it would appear that the U.S. Justice Department is threatening. We're going to take away some funding from you if you continue not to cooperate with federal immigration law. Is this likely to happen, and how is the district responding?
Likely not to happen. Three cities, I think, San Francisco, Chicago, and Philadelphia, have all gone into court to challenge the Justice Department's and Attorney General Sessions' effort to get more local cooperation with federal immigration officials. They sent out a letter this week to 29 jurisdictions, the district being the only one in this immediate area, saying that you are not properly complying with the law, and that we may cut your funding for various federal programs. The idea is whether or not local law enforcement or health officials will immediately upon having someone in their custody for any reason ask or inquire about their immigration status, and if found to be an undocumented immigrant, then report them to ICE or to hold them in beyond their prison sentences or jail sentences until ICE can come get them. And a lot of local people say, we cannot do that. If there's some violent crime, we can work on that. But, you know, if we try to hold every person we arrest, people will be reluctant to call the police. People will be reluctant to seek health care or family and child care. And so we won't do it. The federal law is pretty soft in terms of what you should do is what you have to do. And I think that's where the issue is in the courts.
Susan Swecker, were you surprised that this issue came up in the Virginia gubernatorial campaign, despite the fact that there are literally no sanctuary cities in Virginia?
Well, I guess I was surprised about a lot of things in this gubernatorial campaign. But I think that's one of the reasons people are so turned off by politics these days. And I was, you know, I've always trusted the voters of Virginia, and I knew in the end I didn't think that they would buy that bogus argument or bogus ad by Ed Gillespie, and I felt good that they rejected that, as well as other ads such as like the MS-13, the idea that, you know, Ralph Northam would align himself with MS-13 was just about as crazy as the sanctuary cities.
And that was really out of Ed Gillespie's record, his history as a Republican. You know, he was criticized by the conservatives as being, quote, establishment Ed. But in fact, and even the Northam campaign, are we getting into this enough that I'd say this? The Northam campaign was telling me back when they were up here for a debate that they had done polling that Ed Gillespie was well respected. Well, I think we'll get into some more. And that, but so these ads were actually somewhat out of character for him.
Bill. Go ahead, please.
No, that was I've never met Ed Gillespie, but that was everything I had always heard about him, and I think he was trying to have it both ways, and it backfired on him.
Well, something that should be of interest to Democrats and Republicans in the Commonwealth of Virginia, and that is, Tom Sherwood, the report by former U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray Hood making recommendations for changes to Metro. The study called for replacing Metro's entire 16-member board with a 5-member reform board for three years. That's mildly controversial. However, Mr. LaHood, Secretary LaHood, did not jump into what tends to be the more controversial issue. He simply recommended that the agency be provided with permanent dedicated funding, but sidesteps the question of exactly how that should be accomplished.
And that is the boulder in the room for this. The former Secretary of Transportation was hired by Governor McAuliffe to give some guidelines to the state of Virginia, particularly on how it could approach its share of fixing Metro and whether or not there would be a dedicated funding source coming out of the General Assembly. And frankly, the Secretary whiffed on that. He described the room but gave no exits. He didn't say it's vitally important for Virginia and Maryland to come up with a dedicated source of revenue. The city would do a 1% sales tax. He just said, well, you need to do it. Well, they could have paid me a lot less money to say that. You know, what the hell? Do something. So a lot of people are disappointed in the secretary's report because he basically re-described the chairs on the Titanic. Metro is failing, and Virginia and Maryland can either save it or watch it get worse and worse and worse. And so this report... whether we have 3-member board or 16-member board or whatever member board, or whether we just do it by robotics, the fact is Metro needs money. Yes, it needs to fix its pension plan. Yes, it needs to fix its personnel plan. Yes, it needs to fix its construction plans. But it has to have money to do all those things, and this report disappointed a lot of people.
We will have to see how the politics play out. We will ask the governor when he comes in, Governor.
I don't have any opinions or feelings about this.
Visiting us, Nick. Yes, and we also have Metro General Manager Paul Wiedefeld coming in on Monday, so we'll see what he feels about it. Okay. But on to the elections last week in Virginia. Susan Swecker, I guess congratulations are still in order on the sweep that stunned a lot of people in Virginia last week. It's easy to assume that, well, Democrats just did everything right in campaigns this election because the wins were so decisive, but it might be dangerous for Democrats to assume that's the case, especially since it seems much of the energy was anti-Trump rather than for a particular candidate. You may disagree, but as Virginia party chair, what lessons, positive or negative, did you see coming out of that election?
Well, I think you have a good point there. I think we have to step back and take a deep breath. And I want to, we have a Democratic committee meeting coming up, and I do think I want to toast all of our...
National Democratic meeting?
No, this is a
Virginia State Democratic.
Yeah, okay. First weekend in December. And I do want to give a shout-out to all our party activists and leaders for the hard work that they did to help make this possible. Because sometimes I think during this past year when I wanted to put... stay in bed a little longer and keep the covers over my head and I wonder what happened to our country. We did win Virginia last year, and we picked up a congressional seat, and we defeated a right to work amendment, constitutional amendment, and we elected a 35-year-old African American mayor in the city of Richmond who's doing great things. So, we did have a pretty good year. So I think we did something right last year, and I was just, kept thinking, let's replicate that. We've had a pretty good track record with 2 United States senators.
Yes, you're one of those United Senators. State Senators Tim Kaine has gone so far as to now declare Virginia a blue state, given the Democratic changes and growing population and the historic wins. Do you think Virginia is now a blue state?
I think we're trending there, but I'm always very cautious about saying that. And I think one of the reasons that I would be more comfortable in saying that if we would have some nonpartisan redistricting and make the state house and state senate a little bit more fair, because I think that's one of the problems that we have had is when you have the extreme partisan gerrymandering that has made us get to this polar opposites, and maybe this wake up call that we had on Tuesday with this great sea change in the House of Delegates will make everyone, both Democrats and Republicans, come together better. I mean, 15 at this rate pickups, which I have to say, even I didn't see coming. And I think people want change, and they don't want this, you know, this divisive hatred and bigotry that they have seen at the national level seep down to here in Virginia at the local level. And this spoke to, you know, spoke to not wanting to argue over social issues, you know, to continue to have Ralph Northam be that brick wall and defend women's rights, to continue on Terry McAuliffe's legacy, you know, very progressive legacy of the restoration of rights policy that he started.
Let me ask you, I got the sense the Democratic Party before the election and the surprising strength of the election, you guys were very disappointed that Donald Trump didn't come to the state.
Well, you know what was funny? I'll say this. They send Mike Pence to Virginia, but it was almost like they were hiding him. They send him to Bristol. And, you know, I have to say, I'm no big deal. But, look, I got more people that would turn out for me than they got turned out for the vice president
of the
United
dope.
States.
Can we, and a lot of people
I was glad you raised the issue about the restoration of felon rights in Virginia, because when Edgar Lespie began to attack Ralph Northam for that, it would appear that some of the polls show that that's when Edgar Lespie began to lose some of the black voters that he had. And in addition to a very strong campaign to get out the black vote, it seems that those ads were a major turnoff for black voters that caused a number of them to swing towards Ralph Northam. How important was the black vote? The black vote was 20% in this.
Yeah, I mean, how insulting was that? I have been to some of those ceremonies where Governor McAuliffe has restored the rights of people who have paid their dues. And they are very emotional. They are very inspiring. They bring you to tears. And how insulting to someone that has paid their dues to have that, your integrity demeaned that way. So that wouldn't surprise me exactly that would happen. It's the same way with the MS-13 ad. I mean, I have my cousins, you know, I have family that are all stripes. You know, they are all political flavors. And I was a couple weekends before the election, I was with some of them that come from the Shenandoah Valley, which is no bastion of liberalism, you know. And my cousins had met Ralph Northam. And we were laughing, having a few drinks of laughing, and my cousin would come back and keep saying, he is the nicest man. I don't understand. And he was joking, you know, how can he associate with MS-13? For somebody associates with MS-13. So it's the same way with, like, I mean, anybody knows that a man who is a veteran, has served his country, a pediatric doctor that has to go and tell parents that their kids aren't going to make it,
These campaigns were stereotypes on law and order and immigration, and that's where they failed. I think, you know, a lot of our listeners may not know Susan Tweker. Can I just say something about her for a moment?
As we invite you to,
this is,
as
this,
we invite you to call
worried.
Her at 800-433-8850 or go to our live video stream and see her at kojoshow.org. Here's Tom.
When she's talking about the state, it's not, she's not one of these Northern Virginia, as Tom Davis says, New Jersey types. And I actually knew her when I worked for the Washington Post and lived in Richmond as the bureau chief in Richmond for several years, from 82 to almost to early 86. Susan Tweker is from Highland County. Okay. That is a little county, has like only fewer than 2,500 people in it, over there on the Shenandoah border. With what you might as well be in West Virginia.
Okay.
And it went heavily for Edgar Lespie. I looked up the numbers. And you grew up in an area which was, as you just said, the Shenandoah Valley is traditionally Republican. And so I have a question for you, not about your work in Richmond, but how did you become a Democrat?
Yeah. I was, you know, actually born a Democrat. I'd say I'm a Democrat by birth and by choice. And, you know, thank you for mentioning that and our long time and one of the relationship and one of the reasons I wanted to come up here was to see you after all these years. My parents were Democrats. We just grew up talking politics around the kitchen table. It's a little more red now in Highland County than it used to be. So, and I still have a home there. It's actually, you know, where I vote. So I say I live there and I live in Richmond. So I think I'm kind of a good balancer because I live in a little bit of red and a little bit of blue.
could. And, well, there must be one in New York County, 67% to 30%.
That's what you call a shellacking, right?
But you know, there aren't that many votes. It's only like fewer. It's like 1,500 votes, maybe,
yeah,
or less.
Yeah.
It's not much, but the Virginia, you declined to say that it's the blue state. But you know, you guys, you've won all the statewide races, mm-hmm, since 2009. Is that right?
Yes. 2000.
Okay. You've got the two Democratic senators, Tim Kaine and Mark Warner. You've got a race coming up. Corey Stewart's right now.
Yeah.
I think they only announced candidate on the Republican side to challenge Tim Kaine. And you made, as you just said, surprising progress in the General Assembly. What is the status? You have two or three seats in the General Assembly that you are still challenging, or the votes are not done?
Well, he got an email from Katie who said, "Big thanks to Susan and Virginia Democratic Party for their help in making sure overseas Virginia votes are counted. What is the update on the Virginia localities that are either still counting overseas ballots, which were submitted on time but not collected by the election officials, or deciding what overseas ballots to count?"
Okay, so there are three House races that are still pending, and that's the one she's talking about is the one, I believe, in Stafford, Fredericksburg County, that is, it's actually Speaker House seat who's retiring,
right.
And I can't remember the Republican, it's Josh Cole is the Democrat, and there was at first, there's multiple issues there, and one was, and I will stand corrected on this if I find out it's wrong. I think Tom has known me a long time. I'm a straight shooter. I had understood from House Democratic Caucus, the executive director, that there were absentee ballots that arrived, either didn't get picked up or arrived late. We had been told they were a good number of those were military ballots, which I don't care if they're Democratic military ballots or Republican ballots. I think you bend over backwards to count them. Now I'm getting conflicting information as to whether they were or not. But regardless of that, there are multiple problems there. So okay. I'm not sure where that stands.
Well, Bob Thomas is the Republican.
I was going to say Bob Thomas.
Bob Thomas, okay.
So we don't get too down into the weeds on this.
Yeah, into the weeds.
As it stands right now, it would be 51-49 for the Republicans.
Correct.
Unless these races change. There's a two or three that are still in doubt. All the Republicans are saying they believe they're going to go forward. The significance of this is before Tuesday, the election, it was 66-34 Republicans.
Yeah.
I mean, so whether you in fact get to have to share responsibility in the House of Delegates will be nightmarish. It's happened before. Whether you win and become the majority party, or you just barely are behind 51-49. There's an extraordinary change in the General Assembly, and someone up here was even, we talked about Metro, Governor Northam, governor-elect, has said that he wants to do something for Metro, and now you have more Northern Virginians, Democrats, right, who may in fact help out fixing the decision on Metro. But it's a major change for the General Assembly.
When can we expect to know the final outcome of all of this, and so we'll be able to figure out exactly what the balance in the House of Delegates is going to be?
I think they certify the votes this week. And
Before Thanksgiving, I believe.
Yeah.
Is that right?
So that would, yes.
Yeah.
And then you have a certain amount of time. I think it's 10 or so days before you challenge for a recount. So you can go right up into right before session to find out the results, or right before Christmas. So it's going to be a while. There's one particular close race that's very, very close in Newport News. But so it's to be determined. But I'll say this, too. Metro is a big issue. Here's the other one that we have a real possibility now and should happen is Medicaid expansion. I mean, the idea that we have let that not happen in Virginia just because you didn't want the Governor McAuliffe to get something passed. I mean, I don't know any other way to put it. So
the Republicans say they don't want to take the federal bait money now and then end up having to replace it when it starts drying up.
Yeah,
in
malarkey.
Years.
That's our money. We
but
pay
it's like 400,000 people might be
more
eligible. You know,
right.
But on Capitol Hill, you know, the House this week, there's a lot of changes maybe going to be coming to Obamacare. Who knows what the laws are going to be?
Absolutely, and it's something new every day. But I think driving forces I believe on this change election was this access to healthcare
was a major issue.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, regardless of how these other contested elections turn out, there are those who feel that one strategy for taking the House of Delegates would be appointing some Republicans to top jobs in the Northam administration. There's certainly a precedent for that, but in this polarized political environment, what do you think it might take to convince a Republican to jump ship and allow the legislature to change hands?
I mean, that's a good question. And, you know, there's precedent for that on both sides. But I also think maybe some Republicans need to think about, like, doing the right thing and, like, passing, you know, Medicaid expansion. I do think you will find, and a lot of people will tell you, Republicans will say they like Dr. Ralph Northam, and they find him to be, you know, very persuasive. The one thing he does know is health care, and he's inside and out. So I think it's incumbent upon both sides to meet in the middle and try to find solutions. I think that's why you see Congress favorability at 10% and why you see Ed Gillespie didn't want Donald Trump in the Commonwealth. And we don't, you know, Virginians don't want that kind of divisive politics.
If I saw a member of the Republican Party, either in the Senate, where it's also very close in terms of who runs the assembly, or a House member, and suddenly he or she takes a job in Northam's administration, I think that would undermine your credibility for whatever job you took. If you knew one of the reasons was to change the political makeup of the General Assembly, that would undercut the very person who takes the job.
Well, we'll have to see if that happens. We got an email from Marie who says, why does your show have only Democrats? Where are the Republicans? Well, Marie, obviously you haven't been listening. We've spoken with every statewide Republican candidate in the election, as well as the Republican Party chair for Virginia. We also have a standing invitation to Republican Congresswoman Barbara Comstock whenever.
And Governor Hogan.
And Governor Hogan of Maryland.
Please, Governor Hogan.
Whenever they would like to join us, it is their choice. But now onto the phones. Here's Iman in Chantilly, Virginia. Put on your headphones, Tom, because you want to hear what Iman has to say. Iman, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon, Coach. Thank you for taking my call. I think that the last election, I learned something. I think the young people, they start waking up. Because we as a Democrat, I usually vote as a Democrat, we realize that we have to get young people who can go out there and do the job. We don't want even the Democrats who are just sitting there and doing nothing. Because our main goal right now is health care and jobs. People don't care about anything else. You see what happened in Oklahoma when young lady went 25 years old and she beat that Republican who's been sitting there for 30 years. I mean, it's time that we need to realize that get rid of all the Democrats who are running right now and find new faces, young people who have energy, who can change the politics.
Is there a challenge, Susan Swecker, is there a challenge in attracting young people as candidates in the party?
Well, not this year in Virginia. And I'll point to two things. Ralph Northam, our governor-elect, won young voters by 39 points. Youth turnout was up 34%, 8 points higher than the last governor's race in 2013. But also, this was, you know, another thing after the devastating results of the 2016 presidential election. You know, I didn't know what we were going to be facing. But, you know, if anything good came out of it, it was we had record number of people and a lot of young people step up to run, step up to get involved, step up to join their local Democratic committees, step up to at every level. And
specifically,
you know,
with women candidates.
I was about to say.
And a lot of them were up here where, you know, Carrie Delaney and Prince William County. I mean, you and I have seen a lot of the changes in Prince William County, but also
I think all these women, all these candidates of color, Danica Rome, first and openly transgender person. What role did the party itself have in fielding these first-time candidates and in supporting them?
Well, some of them that were being recruited before 2016 election, and then some of them, I have to just say, stepped right up there and decided they were going to run. And I give Hillary Clinton some of the credit for that too. It was like women are always the last to they always look and go, it's not my time. There's somebody else can do it better. Usually a man. I'm raising my children. I'm getting my career on track. And I think they just said, damn it. I'm good. If not now, when? And if not me, who? And they stepped up. And, you know, we had, Kathy Tran, Jennifer
Coy. She was
Coy.
On this program, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just, and by the way, I want to mention this one because it's somebody that you know from back in the day. Gerald Jones' son, Jay Jones, is now in the Virginia General Assembly from Norfolk.
Goodness.
I think he'll be the youngest member, 28.
You know, State Senator Adam Eben was telling me that, you know, that there was the state party to answer Kojo's question. I mean, there was an extraordinary, from the time Governor McAuliffe ran, in terms of voter outreach and contacting voters, he said there was over 900,000 people were contacted, 1.5 million email. Don't give me all those numbers.
It
did make a difference for that. But, you know, there has not been a statewide woman elected in Virginia since Mary Sue Terry was the attorney general. That's an issue also with Democrats in Maryland. While we've had this resurgence of women in politics, we also had this equally but disturbing thing of, you know, harassment of women, you know, whether it's in the Congress or whether it's Senator Al Franken or whether it's the President of the United States. The role of women is changing. I think maybe it will be better if we have more women in these statewide federal jobs, so that some of this harassment and abuse.
Do we know what
different.
The atmosphere is in the male-dominated General Assembly in Virginia? Are there issues that you are aware of in that body having to do with sexual harassment?
Wow, that's a lot.
Over what period of time?
Yeah.
Last week or the last 25 years?
I mean, I don't think there's any place there hasn't been issues of sexual harassment. But I think Tom's right. I think things are changing. And, these women that have been, I've met most of them, not all of them, and I am just confident that they are going to bring a new and fresh perspective to the Virginia General Assembly, but also to the Commonwealth. And I want to make one more point. If anybody could read that Washington Post article on Danica Rome and not bring you to tears or just make you get goosebumps. I mean, you're a hard-hearted person.
Bob Marshall.
Didn't get Bob Marshall goosebumps. He wrote a letter to the Post.
Letter in the Post today.
Saying that Danica has a hidden agenda.
Right. It's not very hidden.
She's your transportation person. You know, that's all she talked about.
Highway 28.
Can you ask, we got a tweet from Ethan who says, can you ask why the Virginia Democratic Party backed away from supporting Lee Carter, who went on to win anyway? He was the Democratic Socialist who won in Manassas.
Yeah, I mean, there were several that won that didn't get the funding from the House Democratic Caucus. We, the Democratic Party of Virginia, don't fund candidates. We provide access to the voter file. We do help with trainings, and that's for everybody. So that would be, I know these are nuances, but I have to say, and, you know, maybe we need to rethink how we do things, because there were other candidates that didn't get, either got late funding or late help or didn't get help at all that actually won. So,
well, and also, you know, another historic time with Justin Fairfax, who was on the show recently after the election. You know, back in 2016, there was complaints that you and the state party were trying to block him from becoming the nominee, and you supported the other person. I can't think of her name now. Eileen Fillercorn. But have you patched that all up? Did the campaign fix all of that disquiet?
Yeah, and look, I don't want to go over past history or anything on that. But I will say I take ownership of that hiccup totally. And Justin knows this. I had a death in my family, and I wasn't paying attention. And I had a new staff that never done a convention. You know, we used to do conventions all the time and have big crowds. And I wasn't paying attention, and I let that get past me.
Just for those who didn't know, Justin was not. She was allowed to speak at the state convention, and he was not. And that seemed a heavy tilt. You know, that's enough. Yeah. Can you, anything about, does
Justin
her
is
time
the lieutenant
up?
Governor. There. Yes, her time is up. You got about 30 seconds.
Oh, you want to have any comment on Donna Brazile's extraordinary book criticizing the 2016 campaign?
Yeah, you know, I would just say that I have had my head down working on Virginia and all.
No, she doesn't. Now, just let me cut her off. No, she doesn't want to talk about Donna Brazile. Extraordinary story, though.
I'm getting the news that the Reverend Jesse Jackson was just on CNN. He announced that he has Parkinson's.
Oh, no.
Which, of course, is not ever good news for anyone, but it is, I guess, what it is. Susan Swecker, thank you so much for joining us.
I have enjoyed it so much. I hope you'll have me back.
Uh-oh, she's getting into Terry McAuliffe mode here. We're going to have to uproot her from this shit.
It's very interesting. We didn't ask her if she's ever going to run for public office.
She's been in the party
since the early 80s.
No.
Okay. Susan Swecker is the chair of the Democratic Party of Virginia. She's also a member of the Democratic National Committee. Tom Sherwood, there was one other issue I wanted to talk to you about, and now I can't seem to find... Oh, the several candidates, six Democrats running for Montgomery County Executive.
If we had a phone book, we don't have phone books anymore. If we had one, we would just put it on the ballot.
Exactly right. Six candidates running. What I find interesting is that three of them are running as outsiders, and three of them who are already on the county council are running on the basis of their records, and they all seem to be agreeing on at least the $15 minimum wage that they stood by. Who knows how that will ultimately turn out with their opponents in this campaign, but a lot of people in this race.
There are not a lot of political differences. There are grades of differences on them. You know, there's some people who think that the term limits in Montgomery County were intended to get new people to come in, not for people to move from one public job to another. So that might hurt some of the incumbents. Mark Elrich, George Leventhal, and Roger Berliner. But we'll see. That I have said many times, we are in an upheaval period of time for Maryland politics, particularly in Montgomery County.
We'll have to see what happens. Aisha Braveboy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Aisha Braveboy is an attorney, former member of the General Assembly, and a candidate for state's attorney for Prince George's County. You previously ran for Attorney General of Maryland. Why are you now running for state's attorney?
Well, you know,
you're obsessed with being an attorney.
Well, I do enjoy being an attorney.
For a long time.
I have. Thank you for reminding me. In fact, when I was Ubering over here, my Uber driver accidentally went to Howard University School of Law, where I was a student. And I said, "Hey, it's always nice to be on my campus, but we've got to get down to WAMU."
Howard Law year 2000, right?
Class of 2000. But, you know, I love service, and I've lived in Prince George's County nearly all my life. I'm originally from Washington, D.C., but I've lived there all my life in Prince George's, and I can tell you that it's a beautiful, wonderful county with lots of rich resources. However, we do have some issues that hold us back from really realizing our full potential. And one of those issues is our crime rate. And while we've made great strides over the last several years to reduce crime in many different categories, we still lead the region in auto theft. We have a relatively high homicide rate, as compared to some of our neighboring jurisdictions. And our property theft is pretty high. And so we still have to address these issues so that we can continue to make progress economically.
Thank you. The county is terrific. I was just talking to someone who lives in Hyattsville. We were talking about Mount Rainier and College Park. The mayor was here last week. And it's a remarkable county. It has a lot of good things going for it. But the issues of crime, and ages ago it used to be the behavior of the police department that undercut you. But there is. So how would you address those issues? So what should be done? Is it more severe prosecution? You say these are issues. How would you address those issues?
Well, I think we've got to take all categories of crime seriously. We tend to, and while we should, focus on our more serious violent offenses like homicide, rape, and abuse, and assault. And those crimes are just horrific, and we absolutely must focus our attention and resources on them.
Is the office, Angela Alsobrooks is running now for county executive.
Uh-huh.
Is the office properly staffed? Do you need more money? Do you need more lawyers? Yeah. Do you need more prosecutors?
Well, let me just tell you.
How do you address these?
Yeah. So one of the, well, let's just talk first about the seriousness that needs to be given to property crimes, because that is our number one crime. And so when you ask, what do we need to do differently? We need to devote resources to addressing things like auto theft, vandalism, breaking and entering. Those are serious crimes that affect the quality of life for our residents. And so we have to devote more resources to that. Now, do we have enough resources, which is the next question. No. I mean, our prosecutors are some of the most overworked and underpaid prosecutors in the state and probably in this region. We're competing with the District of Columbia, Montgomery County, and Baltimore City even to retain quality prosecutors. And we are at a competitive disadvantage because we don't offer the same salaries. And we don't have the number of prosecutors we need. So our caseloads are high, and we're under-resourced in terms of staff. And so we have to do a needs assessment. I mean, really the first thing I would do is a needs assessment coming in and really make the argument to the new incoming county executive and the council that the state's attorney's office has to receive an increase in funding so that we can be competitive.
All of the callers we've got so far have to do with crime, so I'm going to go straight to the phones and start with Maureen in Prince George's County. Maureen, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes. Hi, Miss Brave Boy.
Hello.
My question is related to, I guess you could say, trial experience. I'm currently a criminal trial attorney practicing in Prince George's County. So I regularly interact with assistant state's attorneys, and I recognize that their role is to ensure justice is done for victims of crimes as well as the community at large. But I also recognize that a major part of that is deciding what cases should not be tried, which cases should be tried. You know, so I would like to know specifically what type of criminal trial experience you bring or you would bring to the position. Because I know that the last person who was state's attorney without criminal trial experience was Jack Johnson.
Your turn, Aisha.
Okay. Well, I can say that most of my career, obviously, I've been in elected office, and I've done private practice. I've not been an elected, I have not been a prosecutor. However, I have dealt very extremely with the issue of juvenile justice. For the past 13 years, I've been a counsel and one of the founders of the largest diversion programs in Prince George's County. We've diverted over 4,000 children out of the criminal justice system. And one of the things that we often do is have to determine which cases we are going to, or how we are going to decide on the cases that come before us, because we understand that we oftentimes have these children's lives in our hands. Yes, they've committed a crime. Yes, they have to seek some type of corrective action against them, but we also have to take the totality of their circumstances into consideration when deciding how we're going to dispose of their cases. And so I will take that experience and the successes that we've had in that program to the state's attorney's office.
Can I just very quickly on this? I know you haven't tried cases in the courtroom, but in the legislature you were active on domestic violence. That's something that Angela also Brooks has focused on. So that would be something that's on your list of things.
Domestic violence, child abuse, which is one of the most horrific crimes that anyone can experience. And unfortunately, we've had several incidents in our school system where we've had to, the state's attorney's office has had to step in and prosecute individuals abusing our students. And I would continue that aggressively.
Victor Ramirez, a state senator, is running for the same position. Do you know whether he's been a prosecutor?
No. In fact, all of the individuals right now who are running for the
Mitchell
office.
Mitchell Lyles, yeah. Is the other from Bowie.
None of us have been prosecutors, but I think all of us bring our own experiences to the state's attorney's office. And just reality, the state's attorney isn't necessarily trying the cases. They're overseeing
managing
the office and setting a tone for the office. And so I think there are a lot of prosecutors and also judges who I've spoken to. A lot of them have confidence in me because they understand that I will be the advocate for the the state's attorneys, I will ensure that they have the resources they need to do their jobs effectively. But I will also set a tone of transparency, integrity, and toughness, because we cannot be soft on crime in Prince George's County.
Speaking of children earlier, here is Courtney in Upper Marlboro, Maryland. Courtney, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Ms. Braybor. How are you doing today?
Wonderful. Thank you.
I am an educator in the county, and I do have a question that pertains to the safety in our schools. What would you do when it comes to bullying in our schools, as well as protecting our children from pedophiles, which have been, you know, a really big issue in our county?
Huge.
That is a big issue. And I can tell you that one of the biggest things that we have to do as the state's attorney's office is educate. We have to educate our school system, the teachers, the administrators, on the importance of believing children when they tell you that something is wrong. We have to conduct the appropriate and proper investigations into those to those allegations, and ensure that if any teacher, administrator, or teacher's aide is violating a child in any way, that we hold them accountable and prosecute where appropriate, and seek sentences that will restore the confidence in our justice system that we're looking out for children. And as far as bullying, it is a huge problem in our schools. A lot of the bullying starts online and through social media, and it trickles over into the school building. There are several assaults that have occurred in our school as a result of bullying. And honestly, some of our kids, they deal with suicidal ideation as a result of that. So these are serious offenses that could affect the quality of life and safety of students, and they're not to be dismissed.
What would be the prosecutor's, the state's attorney's role
Sure.
in educating students, school personnel, what to do? Is that your role? That sounds like the council or the county executive.
Sure. Yeah, we have community prosecutors. And their role is to go out and ensure that issues that are going on in the community that may result in criminal activity, that we address those with the community.
Okay, if I could ask this very quickly,
sure.
Follow up. You know, there's been a problem in Prince George's County with the alleged inaccurate grades, the grade inflation, and passing people who have not graduated at all. Are those subject possibly? Are there possible crimes involved there? Where do you fit on that?
Yeah, that's a possibility. If there, we have, if there is fraudulent activity going on,
is that something you would look at?
They're changing, if there's a change to what is a public document, absolutely. I mean, I think we have to treat every type of crime seriously in our county. And I'm not saying that there was any crime committed, because there may have been, there may not have been. I'm not sure. I can't say specifically in
this
instance.
But that could be investigated.
But it has to be investigated. And if there are those allegations, we do have a unit within the state's attorney's office that would investigate those allegations and bring charges where appropriate.
This came up in our earlier conversation, but I guess it's worth bringing up again. Here is Esteban in Largo, Maryland. Esteban, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, hello. Good morning. Oftentimes, undocumented residents are victims of crime, but they are afraid to tell because they think that they will be deported. How will you address this issue? Gracias por la oportunidad. Thank you.
Angela also Brooks highlighted the challenge of ensuring that those, especially in Latino communities, feel safe coming forward. How would you ensure that people can report incidents without fear, particularly in the current climate?
I think we got to tell them. We have to go out. We have to make sure that our publications are published in multiple languages, because we have people from all over the world living in Prince George's County. And we have to have an office that reflects the diversity of our county. We definitely need to hire more Hispanic prosecutors, as well as prosecutors coming from African and Caribbean countries, as well as Asian. We have a diverse population, and everyone in our county should know that regardless of whether or not not, they are here documented or undocumented, they have the access. They have access to justice. That will be the message that I will send. We are not interested in deporting people. We want people to seek justice. One of the biggest issues with respect to domestic violence, especially among those who are not here documented, is that they fear, you know, what will happen if they, you know, report that domestic violence. And I want all of the victims to know that if they bring their claims and their complaints to us, we are not going to call ICE or any other agency. We are going to seek justice for them here in Prince George's County and take care of them to the best of our ability.
Will you be checking the immigration status of anyone who's arrested?
Well, I mean, that is not our role. And so, you know, that is something that the state legislature has already determined and decided. And we, our job is to enforce the law. In Maryland.
Go ahead.
We just had Susan Swecker here. We asked her the same question. It's a national issue, and every day somebody new is being brought up, and that is the sexual harassment of women.
Yes.
It's across the board. We asked Susan Swecker, Kojo did, in the General Assembly there in Richmond in state politics, had she seen or experienced anything like this or knew about it, and she said she believes it's everywhere. This is a real important time for women in American politics and government. Where do you sense this is, and what, as a prosecutor, could you do about it?
Well, obviously, if there's an assault, if there's an unwanted touching, then that's certainly something that we can pursue. I mean, some of the claims are civil in nature and some may be criminal in nature. And for those that are criminal in nature, we will create an environment and a culture where those individuals who have been victims feel comfortable coming to our office and understanding that we will take their claims seriously. I think a lot of the women who have not come out and men too, because it's not just women right. who are victims, but men too. They don't because, number one, they think no one will believe them, or they think no one will take it seriously, even if they are believed.
I mean, this is also true in law firms also.
Absolutely.
I mean, in your
yeah.
experience, have you heard about this type of harassment? Have you even experienced
yeah.
it? You know, there's a Me Too campaign of people who are saying, yes, I have been the victim of this, no matter how minor.
Well, I can tell you it happens in every industry.
There's the people who will be bringing the cases to you, the Prince George's County Police Department. There's a Justice Department investigation into discrimination in the Prince George's County Police Department in hiring and in disciplining Black and Hispanic officers. What do you think needs to be done to ensure that officers all receive fair treatment within the department?
Well, I think that one of the things, and we dealt with this, and I dealt with this as a state legislator at the state level, similar allegations were made with respect to the state troopers in Maryland. And one of the things I did was I passed a bill that required the state police to proactively seek and recruit Black, Hispanic, and other minority officers, as well as create an independent office of fair practices. One of the biggest problems is that oftentimes those who are tasked with ensuring that people are being treated fairly within the department, they are on a promotional track, and so they are beholden in some way to the chief. And if the criticism is that the system isn't working and the hierarchy is participating in discrimination, oftentimes those individuals don't feel like they can actually, find that there are these discriminatory practices. So I think an independent office that can look at the practices within law enforcement is extremely important. And if they do find that there is discriminatory practices, that we take the steps to correct it. Because our system of justice only works if everyone feels like they're being treated fairly. And if our officers aren't being treated fairly within the department, then the public won't feel like they're being treated fairly on the streets.
Here is Elizabeth in Hyattsville. Elizabeth, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Thanks very much for having me. My husband and I have just moved, and part of the reason we moved was because we really like the diversity. We've moved from Capitol Hill and love the diversity of the region. But it's predominantly, as you say, minorities. And when I hear crackdown on crime, I think a lot about the race relations and sort of the political situation that we have in the United States right now. And I wonder sort of how do you crack down while still recognizing the tense situation that I think a lot of minorities feel, as well as what are some of the things that you've done and worked it before with collaborative approaches with other organizations to get at the root of a lot of this crime?
Well, you should know, Elizabeth, since you just moved there, let me give you some history. Prince George's Police was under a decade-long federal consent decree to address allegations of excessive force by officers. It improved to the point where the decree was lifted, but there are still concerns. Where do you think the conversation about race and police accountability in Prince George's should be right now?
Sure. I mean, look, I worked for many years at Gabriel Christian Associates, a law firm, and we have handled several police misconduct complaints. And very recently, probably in the last couple of years, we handled one with a gentleman who was arrested, and ultimately it was determined based on the video that was produced that this individual was essentially being harassed and abused by a police officer. That police officer ultimately was prosecuted, found guilty, and is now serving his time. So let me just say that I do understand that we still have a long way to go in this country and in Prince George's County when it comes to race relations and dealing with police misconduct. But bottom line, Prince Georgians should feel safe. They have a right to feel safe in their communities. And so what I have done, especially if you look at my track record in juvenile justice, is those individuals who have committed crimes, when they are referred to our juvenile diversionary program, we provide wraparound services. We get to the underlying issues that are causing their criminal behavior. And we have been successful. Over 4,000 children diverted out of the criminal justice system, a 92%
we have less than a minute
rate. We're almost out of time. I would like for you to comment on Sheila Hickson, the delegate at 40-something yes. years in the state.
Half of her life spent in the General
and
Assembly.
You
did you know her?
With her.
I knew her. I didn't serve
very
on her
briefly.
Committee, but I knew her very, very well. And she's an awesome woman. And I wish her the best.
She was dealing with sexual harassment policies 25 years ago.
And now that she is stepping down after 42 years, there's probably going to be a scramble in Montgomery County to replace her.
Well, they'll have to do a lot of work to do whoever gets elected.
That is certainly the truth. Aisha Braveboy is an attorney, a former member of the General Assembly, and a candidate for state's attorney for Prince George's County. Thank you so much for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
That's it for the show today, but there's always more happening online. We'd like your help in shaping one of our conversations on next Monday's program. The holiday season is approaching, and we know a lot of you are inspired to give time or money to help make your communities better places. So we'd like your suggestions for the best ways D.C. area residents can do that. At kojoshow.org, on the page for this upcoming segment, there's a form where you can submit ideas for where Washingtonians can give back and make a difference. We'll share your recommendations when we're back here Monday. We'll also be talking about why there's a conversation going on right now about decriminalizing fare evasion on Metro Rail and Metro Bus. Until then, have a great weekend. Thanks for listening. Tom Sherwood, any big plans this weekend?
I'm going to National Geographic.
How was your time in Virginia last weekend?
I had a great time. I went in Richmond. You know, it's a beautiful city.
They didn't kick him out. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nam.
The Kojo Nambi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingelisa Schrobsdorf, Ruth Tam, Mark Gunnery, and Avery Kleiman. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.